The designated hour having arrived, I'd like to call to order this special meeting of Ansel Glink's Quorum Forum podcast, the podcast local governments need to do business. In the chair, it's me, Daniel J. Bolin, here for a special meeting to consider an important agenda item, one doing with land banks. But first, let's take the roll. Our first guest is a partner practicing the areas, partner at Ansel Glink, practicing the areas of real estate law, environmental law, and urban redevelopment. He's counsel to the Cook County Land Bank and the South Suburban Land Bank. He develops and employs legal strategies for acquiring and managing and repurposing property. For the listener, he's the one wearing a beard, and I am not. Brent Denson is here.
Great to be with you, Dan.
Brent, I turned 36 years old this week.
Congrats.
And thanks. I thought I would be able to grow a beard by this point in my life. Do you have any advice?
It takes a lot of eating of vegetables, and it takes approximately 3 more years.
Oh, okay, good. I'll keep eating my veggies and keep working on it. Engineer Rick is present, and as is podcast director Smith, we have a quorum. So first, the thing we're here to talk about today are land banks, and they're a tool that municipalities and other units of government use to combat blighted property. Brent, what can you tell us about the kinds of challenges that communities face with blight, vacant and abandoned property, those kinds of things?
Sure. Well, going back decades and decades, there's been a problem of distressed vacant properties that has persisted, especially in urban areas, for a long time. This has not been a new issue that municipalities have been dealing with. Mainly, they've been rooted in what used to be called brownfields, what's still called brownfields, but used to be the main problem of an old industrial site that's gone under and may have some contamination or perceived contamination that keeps a new buyer away. Then maybe there's some tax delinquency that sets in, and now these become these mothballed properties that people just walk by a fenced off area for a while and no one can step in to get them. So for a while, municipalities have been dealing with those type of sites, legacy sites from old industrial plants. There's always been vacant houses that will become a problem for a community, especially in areas around in the south and west sides of Chicago. It's always been a problem to have vacant houses that become problems that need to be knocked down. And then commercial buildings. There's always vacant storefronts in downtown areas that come and go, some of which stay in tax delinquent status for a long time and are sold for taxes and acquired by tax buyers, including the county. And that's all been going on for a long period of time, all of which has created blight in certain areas that we have become familiar with. You see a lot of vacant lots in the south side of Chicago and the west side of Chicago that have been vacant for decades. And some of the blight that comes from those buildings that were up and the vacant lots that followed have been in existence and been managed by the city and the county for a really long time. In 2008, that problem became acute when it came to the foreclosure crisis. Right. And so that's where a lot more of the land banking strategies have been started to be employed, especially here in Illinois. But in general, the issue of blight, having been around for a while, land banks as tools have been around for a while as well, because predating the current recession that we just went through, because it's a tool to address conditions that have existed and probably will exist in some form throughout urban areas as we continue to develop our communities.
So land banks, what is a land bank? I mean, not everybody's familiar with these things. So,
sure.
And it sounds like maybe children in a sandbox bartering with cups of dirt or something.
And that's exactly what it is.
No.
So I think we're done. A land bank is a typical land bank is a government entity of some sort that's tasked with acquiring, managing, and disposing of property. And when it's boiled down, that's what they do. In different states, Michigan has a big land banking statute that sets up land banks throughout the state. Ohio has one. Almost every county in Ohio has a land bank. New York has land banking statutes. Typically, land banks have taken the form of a county level or regional level entity that focuses in on acquiring properties throughout its jurisdiction, and having a staff that knows real estate well, that can employ strategies for acquiring those properties, then using contracts that would help them manage properties at scale, and then using a real estate team to help find new owners. So it's a little bit of economic development, it's a little bit of public works, and it's a little bit of real estate acquisitions all piled into one group that does that work on behalf of a wide area of either municipalities on a county level, or even wide areas of counties on a regional level.
Why is this regional approach so common, do you think?
So let's take Illinois, for example, and it's common in most states. Each municipality has authority, all the authority really it needs, to go to a vacant property that has a vacant house on it in their community and acquire that property. If it's actually a blighted structure. So if the property is well maintained and there's a family living in it and there's not a problem and there's no back taxes, these are not the properties we're talking about. The properties that have no one living there, broken windows, tall grass, there are numerous angles where a municipality can go today and acquire that property. And they do. And they acquire them and they demolish them with their demo authority, which you know very well.
Yeah.
Dan, king of demo. So the reason why you would form a land bank is because the time it takes to bring that up to scale to handle a larger problem than one or two or three properties, but to handle, say, the Cook County land bank's load this past year, 400 properties in, 400 properties out, and that will probably double in the next couple of years.
Wow.
To handle that scale, you need to have someone whose primary focus is, and maybe multiple people whose primary focus is, developing legal strategies to acquire these properties. How do you get the contracts to mow the lawns, to do all this type of work, and how do you really engage in the marketplace to set up and create new demand for these lots? It doesn't make sense for every municipality, especially take the south suburbs of Cook County. You have numerous small little villages. Each village might have one economic development director or no economic development director.
Right.
They certainly don't have the capacity to have three staff members focused only on this one issue. So like any regional issue, it makes more sense to have everyone pool their resources and to have those three experts be able to do the work for all of the areas. And especially with land banking, most of the work can be done from your desktop. Most of the work only requires 3 to 4 people to do, and you can cover an exponential stretch of land or territory when you have those three people. So land banks started because, much like other regional problems, it made sense to have a couple people handle this problem on behalf of everyone, and then you can pick those people to be experts in the field, and everyone gets the benefit of having their employee, the employee of the land bank that they belong to, be an expert, even though they don't have anyone on their current payroll that does that.
Maybe walk me through the life cycle of like one of these properties. I've heard about, you said, talked a bit about municipalities or land banks going out and acquiring these properties. What happens to them and how do they get returned to productive use?
Sure. So the typical beginning of a land bank property life cycle would start with some sort of flag being put up on a property, whether it's on a delinquent tax roll, or a lot of times it's the municipality itself that's flagging these properties, their streets and sanitation or public works that is currently mowing lawns and seeing houses or commercial buildings that are starting to become a problem. Or they're recognizing valuable property that has been stuck behind tax delinquency, and so it fits a certain criteria that the land banks help educate their members and other communities that they work with to look for these type of features. But the number one feature is blight. And so you start with a blighted structure, someone telling the land bank about this, asking them to do something. So then you look into, what can we do on this property? Does it have back taxes? Is the primary question, because a government land bank, whether it's an intergovernmental land bank, which we'll talk about in a little bit, or a county level land bank, however it's structured, at its root, it's exercising government authority, and that government authority does one thing particularly well that the private market doesn't, and that's intervene in tax delinquent properties, because the taxes are owed to the government unit. And so they're the ones that control what to do with that property at that stage. when the private market, the only way you acquire a property that has back taxes, if you're a private buyer, is to pay the back taxes. If those back taxes exceed the value of the property, no one will do that. So the government will step in with, particularly on properties where there's back taxes, because it can leverage that authority to start to get that property out of title purgatory and back into clean title owned by the land bank. So typically they would engage in some sort of assessment of strategy. Once we identify the strategy, we start to employ the strategy. So it may be that we file some sort of petition with the court to exercise our authority to take title of the property. Oftentimes we get a list of people that are associated with that property, and we send out old school private eyes to go try to find those people and see if they want to give us their property, and talk to them about ways that we could structure that donation, that they can maybe take some sort of tax write-off if it's a company. That's typically with commercial property, but some sort of engagement in the owner. Once we find an angle of how we're going to acquire the property, then we start to employ that strategy to get the property into the land bank. And then once it's in the land bank, it typically shifts into this whole other sector of the land bank, which are asset managers. They work, they're constantly driving around Cook County for the Cook County Land Bank, or the South Suburbs for the South Suburban Land Bank, and assessing the properties, looking at what conditions, how do we secure them? How do we maintain the lawns, et cetera. Then we have, at the same time, realtor, either outside realtors or an inside real estate staff that's looking to sell the property, and they're looking to get people to sign purchase sale agreements. And then we start that process to go sell a property, and would go through the same process you would with any other property with clean title.
Wow, that sounds like a lot, and I can see why you were saying that, like, normal municipalities individually don't have the capacity to do all that necessarily, but having, like, dedicated team that is able to aggregate all these properties, that's a useful approach. Who is getting together and forming these land banks? I know you mentioned the county level, intergovernmental. How are land banks organized? Who's founding these land banks?
So in Illinois, there is not one state statute that enables land banks and sets up the structure of how they should look, which is a blessing and a curse. It's in other states, they have a statute that tells you what a land bank is, how to set one up. And that can be constraining in some ways, because you rely on your state legislature to envision what exactly a land bank should look like, when most of the legislators have never land banked before, or they don't know much about what to do to create a really strategic, streamlined land bank. However, in other states, they then tack on a dedicated funding source for those land banks. So Ohio has land banks that have millions of dollars coming in through a funding source that they collect a portion of a fee that's paid by tax buyers, a small, like, penny on the dollar, but when it's magnified, then each county gets a couple $1 million a year. Wow. To spend on land banking. We don't have that. But what we do have is the ability to then craft our own land banks how we see fit, and we can streamline them and tailor them to the communities that they're working for. So there are two high-functioning land banks in Illinois. There's another land bank that's just getting on its feet, and there's a couple more that are in consideration. But the Cook County Land Bank and the South Suburban Land Bank are the two that have been in functioning for 5+ years now. And both show the different styles of land banks that really, having vetted different structures, these are the two best structures out there. There is the intergovernmental model, which is the South Suburban Land Bank model. And that is a group of municipalities, including at least one home rule. That's the key, Dan. And we have a home rule member joining a group of other members to form a body through an intergovernmental agreement that will exercise a list of powers that are in the intergovernmental agreement that each municipality agrees to share and collectively exercise under the Intergovernmental Cooperation Act. Another one of your favorites, Dan.
Illinois has incredible intergovernmental cooperation powers, and especially it's very popular in Springfield right now to be talking about consolidate all the government. It's very trendy right now, but, like, there's already a lot of power available through the Intergovernmental Cooperation Act, and you've seen it and you've exercised it with the South Suburban Land Bank. There's real opportunities there to share services and share powers to to get things done for local governments, and I think land banks are a great example of it.
That's exactly right, and the same model that would be used for an intergovernmental land bank could be used for a lot of different intergovernmental agencies or shared services that help consolidate some of the functions of government, save tax dollars. It's all around a good thing. So this is that concept employed for acquiring distressed properties. But essentially, they only exercise the power to acquire properties, to abate back taxes to the extent that the property tax code allows them to manage the properties and sell them. The reason why you want a home rule member is because it's nice to be able to do all of those things without having to adhere to some statutory process that is set for non-home rule members. If you only have non-home rule members in your land bank, then you are bound by the authority that's given to you, the board, by its members. If there's no home rule member, there's no way that we can sell the property exercising some other source of authority that would allow us just to sell to someone without going with an appraisal of every single property. And when you're selling hundreds of properties, you can't afford to have appraisals on properties that are worth $1,000 at most. You just need to go sell the property. So that's one model, is having that set up. There's a board, and when they start functioning, they function a lot like any other land bank, but they're drawing from municipal powers. Now, those type of land banks still have to have side agreements with individual members to exercise a couple powers that are really important, abandonment being one of them. Mm-hmm. The land bank, it's our view that the land bank itself does not have statutory authority to file its own petitions for abandonment, because the state statute states that a municipality can file that petition. Now, we're an intergovernmental agency. We're not a municipality when you set up a land bank. It's filled with municipalities, but it's not itself a municipality.
Sure. What is abandonment?
Sure. So abandonment is a process that's set out by state law by which a municipality can go into court and demonstrate to a court that a property fits three conditions. One, it has two or more years of back taxes. Two, it's an unsafe structure in some form. That unsafe structure definition can vary from courtroom to courtroom, but essentially it entails some level of safety concern for the general public. And three, that there's no lawful occupant in the property. If you can demonstrate those three things and you've served every single party that has an interest in the property and they have not come forward and said, "That's my property and I want it," then you have a judgment or declaration of abandonment, and the court issues a new deed to the property to the city, to the municipality, and it comes with no taxes, and it comes with having cleared everything on title except potentially some federal IRS liens or federal liens. So it's a great tool for municipalities to use to go in to a court and acquire properties, because a lot of the blighted properties that a municipality would be looking at to try to do something about fit those three categories. There's not that many properties that are really blighted that you want to take control of and actively transition to some new use that is paid up on its taxes, has no broken windows, is not a public safety hazard at all, or especially has any residents in it. So those three criteria are good criteria to provide municipalities to look for to exercise your authority, which you can exercise without a land bank. And that's something we can talk about more. But land banks, what I've seen is we will have these site agreements where a land bank will consolidate that type of work as well, and we'll go and file 15 actions in the same courtroom on behalf of municipalities that save the municipalities the need to have their village attorney file one or two petitions, learn about the law, look up the title history and provide service lists. By the time one person's doing that, you could add another case onto their caseload, and it takes probably half as much time as that first case did, right, and so on. Another one, another one. When you have a stack of 10, each one is taking a fraction of the time that it would take to do one alone. So you have economies of scale for the economists in the crowd. So I think that goes a long way to exercise the authority given to the body, and to even exercise authority that's not given to the body, like abandonment, but doing it with a side intergovernmental agreement to go to court on the municipality's behalf specifically. The second model is the Cook County Land Bank model, which is a county that is large enough that sets up its own land bank. There really is only one county in Illinois that it makes sense, primarily because of, what was that home rule statement I said before? You got to have a home rule member. And if you're a county-only government and every county except for Cook County is non-home rule, that's going to be a problem. Right. So there really is going to be only one county-level land bank that we are going to have. The rest are probably going to be intergovernmental, but they may be a bunch of counties together. So downstate, where there's a land bank capacity grant we're working on with IDA to help other counties throughout the state look at land banking. And it looks very different in rural areas than it does in Cook County. And it may be even a broader region, such as the entire west side or east side of downstate Illinois.
Who is IDA?
IDA is the Illinois Housing Development Authority, and they, among other things, have money that they use for grants for blight reduction. And so they help. They have a couple different grant programs. They have a new one to help vet the concept of land banking throughout the state. And actually, it's not available for the Chicago metro area, the five collar counties.
It's like a downstate focus.
It's a downstate or, you know, outside the Chicago metro area, so even upstate, but not around here. So yeah, that's what land banks, that's what they're, how they're structured, but essentially they end up operating the same. The one distinction is, if you have a land bank in your only municipalities, which is the South Suburban Land Bank, you're missing one key element, which is the county's role in the tax process.
Right.
So you really have to work cooperatively with your county if they're not a member. Vermilion County Land Bank, which is the third land bank, but is just getting on its feet, is a combination. Every municipality, decent-sized municipality inside the county, so there's 17 of them, and the county joined. So they have the additional authority of having the tax trustee role be part of the land bank. And so they can go into court and file tax petitions for just tax-delinquent properties, which most counties have hundreds of them, if not thousands of them. Cook County has 20,000 that are out there. So it's a lot of properties that the land bank could touch if it has the taxing authority or the tax collection authority of the county. And it provides a great pathway to acquire property when you don't have any other options of engaging an owner. If the owner's left or it's a really bad situation, usually the tax process is the best way to go after them.
Right, because it seems that the delinquent taxes on these vacant blighted properties seem like one of the big barriers to a market solution to restoring the property. But for these delinquent taxes, the property might have been restored on its own. But like through these different procedures that you're talking about, and with the cooperation of the county, which sounds very important, it sounds like you're able to clear off those back taxes and help return these properties back to productive, a tax-generating use.
That's right. And what's interesting about these back taxes is it's a double-edged sword for land banks. The taxes are the reason that these properties have been locked into blight. So that may be the reason they first started to become blighted. And that may not be the reason that the property became vacant. But over time, the taxes are what locks it in to long-term blight and deterioration. So it's the source of the problem. It also, at the same time, is the source of the solution for the land bank, because it's their number one power that they can wield to go in and get those properties, to get them back in the rolls, is the fact that the back taxes allow them to go in and acquire title. So you have this problem with distressed properties, is that they're still owned by a citizen of the United States who has property rights, and you can't just take their property.
Right.
And so the back taxes being the problem and the cause of the problem of keeping it blighted also give the opening for a government entity to say, yes, but you didn't pay your taxes, and so now we have this avenue to go take the property back from you that we otherwise wouldn't have if the taxes were paid. So it's a little bit strange. We actually look for properties with back taxes because those are the ones the land bank can best engage in, and likely those are the ones that are the ones that need the most help. So it meets in a perfect intersection that allows land banks to be effective, and that's why land banking has become more and more of a preferred tool.
Right. It sounds like someday there's going to be land banks everywhere.
We can only dream.
Which is your dream. Until that happens, what are some of the tools available to municipalities to address blight? Like right now, this summer, the grass is getting long on the properties all over Illinois right now, and municipalities are having to mow these vacant properties. What can they do?
That's a good question. So the powers that are exercised by either land bank style, the intergovernmental land bank or the county land bank, if you remember, all derive from the common source of it being a municipal power or a counterpower that already exists. Mm-hmm. So there is no power that's added by creating a land bank. It's just exercising that power in a more efficient and effective manner. So that being said, all municipal listeners right now could start tomorrow land banking. And in fact, we have clients that you've worked with that are land banking, and they're acquiring properties using the exact same techniques. They're bringing them in, they're managing them, and they're selling them. And so most municipalities in some shape or form have been land banking for some time. It's the scale of which they can do that is really the big issue that a land bank can help resolve. So municipalities can and should look actively at their abandonment authority and start to exercise it, because the cost of not directly intervening in a property is far higher than the cost of filing an abandonment petition. And I think that's what municipalities are seeing more and more of. They end up cutting the grass for a couple different summer cycles, and that's the cost right there of sending someone in there to acquire title. And I think a lot of municipalities over time were saying, well, we don't want to own the land. We're not in the business of owning land. But you are in the business of trying to push that property into a better use. A, because it will increase the tax base. B, it will help support other the general health and welfare of the community and other initiatives that the municipality has. And all of those final goals rely on someone intervening in the property and pushing in the right direction. And so maybe an incentive might work in some scenarios. Most often it requires actually stepping into title and becoming the landowner. And it's far cheaper and more effective to actively engage in these properties and acquire them than it is to cut the lawn lean and push someone else to pay and step in and accept their responsibility for managing their own property. Not all properties, but there's definitely a subset that it can help. One quick story to also show why abandonment is a good tool on the municipal level or with exercising it through a land bank. There were a string of 15 properties in a south suburban community that were vacant, had been foreclosed on, and the taxes, you can watch this from your desktop, you can see the taxes not paid 1 year, not paid a second year. Now they qualify for abandonment. At that stage, that property has been abandoned for about 2 years. It was a well-kept house, and municipal inspection showed on all 15 property significant value still in this house. Not only that, it's in the middle of a community that is otherwise stable. And these 15 properties could be the tipping point for that neighborhood. So they filed 15 petitions for abandonment and acquired the properties, each for about, because they were all put together, probably $2,000 to $3,000 in total to acquire the property. Which if you think you're acquiring a property, there's no way you'd even buy a property for that amount. So it's a very low dollar amount to acquire clean title, no back taxes, no mortgages. It comes in at that rate. They then turned with the real estate team, worked with the land bank on this side, but sold each property to a new landowner, new homeowner that was buying it to be their primary residence at a significant discount to encourage people to acquire the properties, but still for $20,000 to $40,000. And leaving some room for them to fix up the properties, use their money instead of buying the property with all of their money. They save some to put into the property itself, which is part of the goal, to have them have money left over to fix the windows, to fix the siding. So that's built into the actual disposition strategy. All properties have been sold. It generated net program income for the land bank. It eliminated a problem. It stabilized the community. Across the board, a win for everyone. That was rooted in the abandonment authority of that municipality. And that authority exists today for every municipality, home rule or not home rule, across Illinois.
So there's a lot of opportunity here to turn around these problem properties. These are the ones that people are getting calls about at City Hall, and the real ones. If you're able to successfully intervene and turn these properties around, generate more tax revenue for your community, you make the neighbors happy, and that neighborhood stabilization item, like not only did you in the story you told, like did was that community able to intervene for those 15 properties, but the external benefits for the entire neighborhood have to be very substantial.
That's right. And so it's a win-win, especially because the work you're doing actually generates some value. So you're unlocking value in some of these properties that are locked behind back taxes or behind some condition or other perceived condition that keeps the private market away. And when you unlock that value, you can capture some of it if you're structuring this correctly and bring it back to pay for the other projects you have. So the Cook County Land Bank, for example, both land banks take no tax dollars. They started with grants, and so to get on their feet, it does require some sort of investment to get the initial pieces in play. But the Cook County Land Bank had a $16 million budget last year, and all of that money was brought in through the sale of their properties that they acquired. Wow. And so if you think about it, and actually brought in more than that. And so it is they make their own money and then employ it to pay for city services that are currently being taken out of general obligation funds. So it's a great tool, and in fact it has a lot of bipartisan support throughout the country and in Illinois. The Vermilion County Land Bank is a Republican-driven concept by Mark Maron, their county representative. In Cook County, it was more of a Democratic-driven concept. Because it's good governance, it saves tax dollars, it allows the market value of these properties to pay for the services that you're providing as opposed to tax dollar payments. And the service you're providing increases the value of the properties around it so that it brings in more tax revenue. And certainly the neighbors appreciate it, whether it's tax dollars being spent on it or not, what you're doing to their neighboring property. So it's a kind of a win-win across the board, some of which the properties have significant value. It can be there's properties that have been sold by the land bank for $250,000 to $500,000. Two of those properties were acquired for $10,000 or less. So you talk about an amazing amount of program income to pay for a whole suite of services, mainly demolitions, which are net losses, but they're paid for by a net win by freeing up a warehouse that hasn't been in use for a while because it has millions of dollars in back taxes. So it's a win-win across the board, but to stress, you don't need to have a land bank to start. It just helps to actually create that scale where you can identify the wins and balance the losses. That's something that's very difficult in most city halls to have staff really work at that granular level. Even the most capable city halls still struggle to have enough staff to do the research and data collection to strategically employ your powers.
So it helps to have a land bank.
It does.
Hey, got any final thoughts on land banks before we move on with our agenda today?
I don't. I would encourage people if they have further questions to look at our website. They can always contact me to ask questions about how land banks work. And I would also encourage you to look at the issues in your community as being solvable and try to look at some of those, especially around blight, that you don't have to wait for a state grant. You can start to employ some of your authority in a way that might pay for itself. It has proven in other counties to do that, but it requires some local leadership to start getting some of these concepts off the ground.
That's incredible. Thank you for talking to us about that today. But this is a special meeting, and we are still required to have public comment. And so we'll move on to the next part of our agenda. We'll take a look at some of the questions that we get here sometimes. I think that there is a question here. Are employees with whom the village has an employment contract entitled to a hearing before their contract expires if the village board elects not to renew the agreement? Do you have any thoughts on that one?
I do. Off the top of my head, I think I might know the answer. Only if the contract requires it, Dan. A federal appeals court recently ruled in favor of a municipality in a lawsuit brought by a former village manager who alleged that the village's failure to provide a hearing before it chose not to renew its contract violated his due process rights. And just off the top of my head, the Seventh Circuit held that the former manager had no federal property right to remain as village manager, so no due process requirements applied. In short, the Seventh Circuit held that a former manager had no federal constitutional right to a hearing on the village's decision not to renew his contract. But that's just what I remember, so there might be more out there.
Oh, yeah, there probably is, but like I think that's a great answer, and I'm impressed with your extemporaneous response. Next is from Google Wave user Snark District said, Dan, I heard you were going to appear on the Judge John Hodgman podcast. How did it go? Brent, I don't know if you remember from our last episode, we talked about my upcoming appearance, now past appearance on Judge John Hodgman podcast. For if you're not familiar, he's a famous internet judge. He usually hears disputes between couples. The husband's usually the monster. I brought this case against my wife, and I probably am the monster. But the she's wonderful, but she walks around our house watching shows about murder on her iPad without headphones, just filling our home with the sounds of screaming victims.
Maybe sending a slight message to you.
just a subtle reminder.
Oh yeah, I'm very careful. I'll let everybody know that I appeared on the podcast. I did prevail. I won an order to require her to wear headphones. Is she complying with that order? Not yet, but we'll see how it goes. But I would expect that you. I do not have children, so I have time to file these frivolous disputes in internet court. You have children, and your home is probably filled with the sounds of screams from time to time.
It is, and it's just refreshing to know that a lawyer can go in and file an action against an unrepresented spouse and get a court order against it. It really warms my heart.
Oh, you know what? I need these wins in my life to feel better about myself.
Well, congrats, Dan. I'm really proud of you.
Thanks so much. But in any event, before we go, I just want to remind everyone to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. We prefer good reviews, ones with more stars than less stars, if you have the option. If you have questions and show ideas, you can email us at podcast@anselglink.com. That's a real email address. Don't forget to visit our website, quorumforum.anselglink.com. That'll bring you back to this episode. More information about the land banks that we were talking about here today. Can I get a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second. All in favor? The ayes have it. We'll see you next time on Ansel Glink's Quorum Forum podcast.